Inside Crime is brought to you by DoTerra. The DoTerra drug deactivation system helps stop opioid misuse before it starts. With DoTerra, unused prescription opioids and other drugs are gone for good. I'm Angeline Hartman. I've spent my career as a journalist covering some of the worst crimes in history. My craft is storytelling. My passion is crime fighting. Now I'm bringing you more stories, candid conversations with crime victims, their families, and law enforcement. We'll journey together as we learn what happens inside crime. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Inside Crime. I'm your host, Angeline Hartman. And on today's episode, we'll talk to my good friend, retired Atlanta homicide detective, David Quinn. If you were with us on an earlier episode of Inside Crime, you know that David and his former partner, Vince Velasquez, worked homicide together for 15 years. Now, they're the stars of a hit television show, ATL Homicide, on the TV One network. On that show, the retired detectives talk about the real-life cases they worked. They narrate and navigate us through the twists and turns of each investigation, while two actors play younger versions of David and Vince at the same time. The concept is pretty cool, and true crime fans just love it. Today, David will talk about what he's learned after all of those years working homicide. He'll give some very important advice to law enforcement professionals and families of crime victims. We'll also talk about a bizarre case we worked on together. First, here's a little taste of ATL Homicide.
We arrive at an apartment complex in the west side of the city. Paramedics are already on scene, tending to the unconscious victim. But it's a woman. It looks like she's been beaten. She's in and out of consciousness. Visible injuries, severe injuries to her face and her head.
Lady putting out the trash actually found her. Dial 911, get this sister some medical attention. She's like the first part of our clock.
All right, O'Neal, right with her. Maybe she wakes up and says something.
We don't know if she's gonna regain consciousness, but dying declarations are admissible in court.
You know, Drew, start canvassing the area, see if anybody sees anything.
Copy that.
Vince has delegated. He looks like a DJ on the ones and twos. He's telling crime scene techs to pick this, collect that. He's doing his thing.
Calhoun, you get anything yet?
No, nothing yet.
You check this trash right here?
All right, I'm on. Thanks, man. Good man.
Yeah. The area around where she was at wasn't disturbed, nothing.
It's as if this sister literally fell out of the sky.
Welcome to Inside Crime, David Quinn.
Thanks for having me.
Quinny, I've known you for a long time, and I cannot even tell you how happy I am about you and your success. You're having a good year.
I'm happy, but Angeline, we got to like give the chronology here. I mean, without you, this would have never happened. I wouldn't go near a camera inside of 15 years ago. When you were here with the local affiliate, you introduced me, you know, to this information superhighway, and I'm grateful.
Wow.
Goes back to you.
I appreciate you. That was a long time ago, and it's funny to think about. I mean, you were just a baby, and you definitely were saying, nope, that's not my thing. It was just hard to imagine now.
Yeah, I was just raw. I mean, really resistant to change or exposing my people in the street, which to me was my constituency. I felt like a sellout if I went on the media.
Yeah.
But with you and also Vince. Vince was doing TV with his murders back in the day. I just didn't do it. I didn't believe in it. And then once you put the smile on me and said, you should try this, I did it with you the first time, and it revolutionized the way I look at homicide investigation. It totally changed it.
Wow. Wow, that means a lot. That really means a lot, Quinny. Just to fill people in, I was a reporter for many years here in Atlanta, and you had just started homicide. And
in the year 2000, yeah.
Yeah,
And so that's where it all began. And then eventually I went to America's Most Wanted, and then...
You came back for some home cooking.
Home
you came back to the ATL looking for content, and here we were.
Well, that's one of my most memorable, out of all the stories I've done at America's Most Wanted, the one I did with you, murder case, involving the victim was Mamadou Barry, and that continues to be not just me, because of my work with you, but the Mamadou Barry case is so memorable for many reasons, but maybe you can break it down in a simple way, because it's a complicated story.
It's such a complicated story, but when you came wanting to showcase this homicide on national TV, I believed in you, so I did it. It was my first time going on television talking about a murder investigation. And I decided, once I committed to being with you on this, I was going to give everything up that I had. I had nothing. I had a dead man in a bathtub inside of his home for more than 6 or 7 days, affixed to a shower rail. That's all I had. I had no fingerprints. I had no witnesses. I had no timeline, no surveillance cameras. We put it out there. And that case, which is long, complicated, and well-distinguished in the city of Atlanta, it doesn't get solved without media exposure. It doesn't happen. The catalyst for that investigation coming to a close was being on television. That was it.
That's amazing, because that was really, as you said, your very first time to do something like this. And not only is it your first time, you're doing it on a national level with, I mean, dare I say, America's Most Wanted, the number one, you know, crime reality show at the time of America, and it works from A to Z.
It blew me away. I was sold. Mm-hmm. I was into this. Mm-hmm. And I was going to be hammered a year, because every murder I got after that, I was going on television.
So the victim in that case was Mamadou Barry.
Absolutely.
And can you tell me just a little bit about him, and let's step into the background, because this case is so interesting on all levels.
Mamadou Barry was an immigrant from Guinea in Southwest Africa. You know, he's raised on the coast, comes to America, and finds out there is a real market here for entrepreneurs. This was a virgin territory for entrepreneurs in the city of Atlanta, early 2000s.
Right.
Mamadou becomes an importer-exporter. Mm-hmm. And I mean, he's bringing in so many items. He finds out what the community is thirsty for, and he provides that service or product. And it, you know, he found out and tapped into the community, the urban community in particular, and found out what they wanted to purchase. And he imported and exported all this stuff. And he made a lot of money.
He's going after the American dream.
He is chasing it. And he realized it inside of about 3 years. He had amassed a small fortune, mm-hmm, just by catering to the community that he lived in. Mm-hmm. It was unbelievable. And so what happens in a lot of cases, people want your wealth. And they want it by any means necessary. They're going to do whatever they got to do to take your money. A group of folks that called themselves the International Robin Crew, they set up on Mamadou for weeks, conducted surveillance. They thought they were going to get the keys to the kingdom. And what they got was, you know, it was mayhem. Mayhem they created, and they put this on this one man, Mamadou Barry. His money was in the bank, and these guys thought his money was inside his home. That was their plan. Or inside of one of his two businesses. Mm-hmm. That was their plan. They weren't thinking global. Mamadou had about $500,000, you know, in one bank and several hundred thousand dollars in another bank. And they couldn't breach, you know, that security platform. And so they opened up Mamadou Barry's business while he's suffering and dying in his bathtub. He was dead, but he was laying undiscovered for about a week, and they opened up his business, and it was commerce and trade going on the loading dock of his warehouse for about a week.
So just to be clear, so they go to his home, they're looking for money. It doesn't turn out the way they think or whatever. They end up killing him in his bathtub and take whatever they need to take. They go to his business now and try and get what they can get there while he's at home.
Absolutely. They set up on him. They break in his house while he's at work, and other members of the gang are conducting surveillance on him at one of his businesses, his retail establishment. And so they're on the cell phones, you know, acting like they're the FBI. And one of the members of the gang was inside of Mamadou's house when Mamadou comes home. And the other gang members converge on that same apartment, and they begin to torture Mamadou, thinking he's got hundreds of thousands of dollars inside his home, which was an apartment in Southwest Atlanta. There's no money there. So at some point, they figure out where his commercial business is, where he keeps all his merchandise, everything he's used to make his fortune here in Atlanta. They now have the keys to the kingdom. So they kill Mamadou. They make a decision while Mamadou is still alive to kill him. They discuss his fate in front of him in that fateful bathroom tub. They kill him. They suffocate this man to death, and they go to his business like the cold-blooded killers that they were, and they open it up for business, their business.
Horrible.
And they sell his merchandise right off the loading dock while he's, you know, decaying in his bathtub for a week. It was an unbelievable story. And what was so unbelievable about it was that the relationships that I had to put together with two of the participants in the gang to find out what happened and get the answers, it changed me forever. Still gives me the chills, you know, the meetings we had trying to understand what really happened here. This wasn't going to be a witness DNA case, a fingerprint case. This was going to be witness testimony with corroborative evidence based on that witness testimony.
And so when we ended up doing this at America's Most Wanted, you basically have a little bit of information, but not enough. Obviously, you have the story to put out there, and you wanted to get more information, obviously.
I remember I gave you all of my crime scene photos. I gave you full authority over my case file, which was against departmental regulation. I said, if I don't have it, I'm giving it up. And that became my mantra. Tell it all. If you got nothing, tell it all. Mm-hmm. I think the police across the nation, maybe across the world, they got this culture of keeping secrets, not telling the families, not telling the public what you're doing. It's like a cop secret. And so what happens a lot of times, evidence never gets developed because no one knows that information's out there. I always would link up with a family member on all my murders, an auntie that probably knew more about my victim than his mama.
Right.
And I would just give it up. And so with this new, you know, tool, the media that you introduced me to, I just decided, let's tell the world. That information, after that thing hit nationally on America's Most Wanted on that Saturday night, it comes back to me like a boomerang, because somebody involved in the murder was watching the show. Saturday nights was must-see TV back in the day for America's Most Wanted.
Yep.
And based off that little 15-minute movie you guys did on my case, the information came flying at me, hit me right in the head. It was beautiful. It was beautiful.
Wow. Well, this case, so you eventually solved it after one tip led to another thing and led to another thing,
absolutely.
Right? But it really led to, I can't remember, and you may not have all the numbers now, but it was not just this one murder. It led to a whole lot of things.
What I found once my original informant, Carlos Drennan, saw me on television, or he was alerted that I was on a national televised program talking about the case, he decided he got into some trouble and decided to use that as a credit card with the federales got him. I mean, he got tagged by the ATF, and he'd been holding on to this information because the gang members of the International Robin Crew disclosed to him that they had killed Mamadou Barry. Carlos Drennan was not with them when they killed Mamadou Barry. But he was what they call an OG. And these young boys in the gang were trying to, you know, win his, you know, approval and get some confidence in their crime syndicate activities. And Carlos was collecting information on them. And he gave it back to me. Well, the way the story goes, Carlos Drennan eventually stabs me in the back because he's really in the gang and actively in the gang. We come to find out 8 murders were perpetrated by this crew of loosely 15 individuals over a 1.5-year period. About 18 months, this group had killed at least 8 people, and Carlos Drennan had the information. It was unbelievable. Nobody in the department believed it. So it's the case of a lifetime is what it was.
Yeah.
And they were all indicted and charged with 8 murders and a litany of other robberies and crimes associated with cold-blooded murder.
That sounds like a movie.
It felt like one while it was going on. I mean, it really did. I mean, it was the kind of thing where I couldn't really share it with my wife, who was a cop. I couldn't even share it with other cops. I mean, the only person knew about it was Vinny. And at the time, you know, I had to kind of lean on him because it was overwhelming, the amount of material and substantive evidence that had to be put together to bring that to trial. This was, you know, we had to put together a Sammy the Bull Gravato type of prosecution. We had to go straight RICO on this because this was some gangster stuff. These jokers were gangsters. Come to find out, this same group, the International Robbing Crew, and they get that name because some of the members were from North Carolina, some were from Atlanta, and a large number of them were from New Orleans. People that had evacuated from New Orleans right after the Katrina situation. And these ne'er-do-wells settled here and decided to feed off Atlanta. You know, there were a lot of good people that got caught up in that storm. And these jokers really put a downer on what happened in our city after that tragedy. I mean, they really brought us down and brought our numbers for homicide up, way up.
It really is unbelievable when you break it down. All the things they were involved in, all the crimes they committed, and all the people, the communities they affected. And then everything behind that, it is, you can't tell it in a movie. You can't make this stuff up.
It's unbelievable. It stays with you forever. You know, murder investigation definitely has to have a shelf life for a homicide detective. Mm-hmm. You got to figure out what your exit is. But while you're in it, you've got to be all in it. You can't be halfway having a baby. You got to go ahead, get pregnant, have the baby, take the baby home. You got to go full cycle with this thing. And what I'm trying to encourage young detectives around the country and the world, if they're listening, you got to be all in. You've got to be all in this investigation. Mm-hmm. If that means you work murder cases for 5 years and that's all you got, that's all you got. Get out, because if you become a lazy ass, you could kill a generation. You can take out a whole generation because they don't get the answers. And you every murder, every homicide destroys a family. Mm-hmm. So you've got to be 100% on this thing. That's your hobby. That's your life. You have to have that mentality.
Well, you know, not all families, if something happens to them, not all families are lucky enough to have a homicide detective with that kind of thinking, right? So what would your recommendation be? What advice would you give to family members who are impacted by crime? Because we hear this all the time. There's a lot of complaints about how they're treated, you know, their dealings with police. What would you say on the flip side of that to help them out?
I would have to say on the flip side, family members have to demand transparency from their homicide detective. Their homicide detective becomes a part of their family. Now, a lot of cops don't want to acknowledge that, but you become a part of the family because that place that's empty at Thanksgiving's got your face right there. You're with them. You're part of their loss. This is the commitment. And I think that each family should always have one spokesperson. In your grief during this tragedy, elect one spokesperson. Sometimes it's not the mother or the father. Sometimes it's an aunt or a brother, someone that could be a spokesperson for the family. their grievances and their pain has to be acknowledged in a significant way. And the only, you know, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. I don't care what business you're in. You got to demand more out of your homicide detectives. The one thing that me and Vin did when we started our career, we started in homicide the same day in the year 2000. We made detective one day. We were in homicide the very next day. We didn't really know each other. But there was something about us, some organic, maybe we'd been here before type situation when we first met. We would give the mother of our victims our own personal cell phone number. The psychology behind that is you've given the mother access. You've given this loved one suffering this kind of pain and loss access. You give a mama your desk number at the crime scene. Every day you come to work, that light's going to be blinking on your phone. She doesn't have access to you. You give her your cell phone number. She's not going to call you as much because she has access. You've let her in. That's risky. Some people don't want to take that kind of a risk. I'm up for it. I was always amped for that kind of a risk because I want these people. You have to help them through their pain. You can't rely on the victim, witness, advocates to do everything. You've got to give in and of yourself because sometimes you don't close the case, but you got to show effort. People have better peace when the effort is extended. And they can sometimes, they can be forced to live with the result that no one's going to jail if they know you had your heart and soul in it.
But for you, on the reason why other detectives don't do that is because they fear that the victim's family will take advantage of that and call at all hours of the night or call all the time. And so that is a possibility. And so when they call and you're at home and you're watching TV with the kids or in the middle of dinner, I mean, you are literally taking home your work. Talk about the balance between work and home life, because for those that don't know, you are, I mean, it doesn't get more family man than what's at home for you.
I raised 6 kids off the City of Atlanta Police Department's salary. I also had a wife that was a police officer that wasn't going to have the same sympathy as maybe a homemaker or somebody that never went to the streets. So I had to fold clothes and, you know, get kids off to school.
I would like to say that I've seen you folding clothes at home.
You have. You have.
And with cameras in full.
Cameras in full, high chairs everywhere. And, you know, you still have responsibility to your family, but if you make that connection with that family member who becomes that spokesperson, a lot of times it is the mama. There's a mutual respect that's seeded and grown right there when you give up your personal information.
Inside Crime is brought to you by DoTerra. The DoTerra drug deactivation system is an independently tested, safe, and environmentally sound solution that permanently deactivates, destroys, and disposes of unneeded pills, patches, liquids, creams, and films right at home. Be part of the solution to reduce drug abuse. Learn more at DoTerraSystem.com.
If you make that connection with that family member who becomes that spokesperson, a lot of times it is the mama. There's a mutual respect that's seeded and grown right there when you give up your personal information. I have never been harassed by a family because I gave them access. I can raise my hand and I can say that's never happened to me. And, you know, we're talking about some of the cases where there's some really marginalized people as, you know, depicted by society. The marginalized is what society calls marginalized people. Those are my people. And I'm family with these families that have lost. I just never had those issues because I was a free-for-all dude. I was going to go ahead and admit when I didn't have it. Honesty is important when you're a detective. Hey, mama, I'm stumped. I don't know what to do. I mean, sometimes if you just hat in hand about you've bumped your head, you've done all you can do, hey, families love that. It's an ego-driven field, policing. You know, I've did it for 30 years and it's ego over the place, but you got to leave your ego. I got ego. I got it too. But the thing of it is, you have to like come down, get off that high horse and just take it to the people.
Yeah.
It's their loss. It's the community's case as well. Let them in. Give them access. That's what always worked for us.
Atlanta is a sexy, beautiful city. But there's a dark side. We work hundreds of murders.
Homicide is like mental chess, and I'm just waiting for that mistake.
How many calls did you make to check on your wife?
When you tear away all the fibers and the fingerprints, at the end of the day, all you have is a story.
Well, I think for me, what makes this show so popular right now is that I think people can sense that you guys are genuine people who are following the golden rule of treat people how you want to be treated, right? And that's what you guys have been talking about. Secondly, is the chemistry between the two of you and the brotherhood. Let's just talk about what makes him a great homicide detective.
A dedication to order. It has to make sense. He's the compass dude.
Yeah.
He keeps it going. I come off the rails. My stuff is well documented. I'm crunk. I'm a lit dude. I'm always up. Sometimes I gotta come down. You have to have a balance. If we were both the same, this thing wouldn't work. My brother keeps it in the middle of the road, right? But at the same time, both styles complement the finished product.
I mean, but being on TV is not new to you guys because you've done other shows, you've done many shows, different types of media.
I was the reluctant one.
This is different because it's your show, the two of you are at the center of it, whereas 48 Hours, people recognize you a lot through that, but tell me how it feels different to you.
It feels different because it's unvarnished. This is who we were on the street. Me and Vin, we got together in the year 2000 when we came to Homicide. And we knew there was something there organically with us and what we were going to do on these streets. I'm way more than humbled by this because it's up there. But the beautiful part about it is they let us be us. I mean, TV1 said, be you. We are the script. I mean, everything is written behind our words. I thought I was just way too off the scale. You get into something that's constructed. This is constructed, but at the same time, it's almost like a free fall. You get to see the love we have for our community. Our victims are victims' families. We keep saying this every time we talk to somebody. One of our victims' family members is depicted in every episode, or at least a close friend. This is a community tragedy. You give it back to the community. TV1, they gave us the vehicle to bring the real Atlanta out there. This is a glimpse into, you know, what happens in Atlanta in reference to everything else that goes on.
Yeah.
And these are our stories.
I really like that when you talk about they do show a victim, you know, somebody from the family, and they show the real pictures, and it reminds the viewer that you're not just watching a show, this is real life. That's a real person at the center of this.
I know me and Vin did this homicide thing different than anyone else I've ever been around. I've watched cops for 15 years do it their way. The way we did it, which was naturally the way we got down, was we were ourselves out there in the streets. We were very different. My partner is one way, I'm another. He's smart. You know, I'm right out of high school and got this job. My partner, he's very technologically savvy. He's the Jetsons, baby, like way before, you know, the millennial guy here. I mean, he knows things that I just don't know. Now, but conversely, I know the street. Those two entities married together to put together a product that I believe was unstoppable. We got out there and humbled ourselves to the community to bring these murders to closure. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of suffering that goes on, but at the same time, you have to always take it back to your people. the people that you serve. And that's what we want to, we want other law enforcement to watch it. If you think you don't understand it, these are training films. So tune in and see how we did it. It might not work for you, but it's always good. These are training films for cops.
Right.
This stuff is true to form. And it went down in the discovery that went out for the trials. And what's interesting, we're actually showing it. We showed a case last week where we lost one. But we told the story.
Because there's still a story behind
it's
that.
It's still a story. It's still a life lost. And as a family still grieving, you know, it's not always about, so it's not always about pom-poms and, you know, the wins and the high fives. If you do your job, the system works. The system said this person goes home. You respect that.
Right. Let's back up, Quinny. Let's talk about how you got into this business. Did you want to be a cop when you were a little kid? Or,
you know, and since about age six, I wanted to be a police officer.
Wow.
And it's a crazy story why. I remember, and I'm just giving it to you straight, my cousin, my first cousin, who was beloved, he was beloved in my family, he took on a life of crime. And my mother was more or less his big sister. And I remember he was on the run from the police for about a year for a really serious crime. And we used to hide him at the house. And I remember the police came to my grandmother's house one day while we were gone shopping, and they kicked the door down. And they left a warrant on the door for my cousin, like a notice that he was wanted by the police. And eventually he was, you know, given 100 years or whatever it was in the 70s, and we would go visit him in prison.
Man.
And I would sit there on Sundays visiting my first cousin, who was like a brother, and I just realized that's not what I wanted to be. I idolized him. I loved this kid. He ended up doing 20 years, and I kept up with him the whole time. But I always wanted to be a police officer. I don't know why those two situations married each other like that and why I went one way and, you know, some other family members went the other. But I was inspired by, I knew he had done wrong, but I loved him. You know what I mean? And so I just, I couldn't think of any other profession I wanted to participate in. I mean, I would see cops in the town. I grew up in Wilmington, Delaware. It's like a chocolate city right outside of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And I saw the cops and, you know, I liked cop shows. I watched Beretta and Columbo and Starsky and Hutch when I was a kid. I mean, it might sound goofy, but that's all I ever wanted. I already knew what I wanted to do, and I wanted to work homicide. I was fascinated by murder, death. I was fascinated by it. Fascinated by funerals because the pain that people were experiencing and the person and the casket, it was just, it was something. I felt like it was a calling. I wanted to be delicate with people and help them find out who killed their loved ones. I saw people get killed growing up, and the curiosity was overwhelming. So it was a natural segue 2 years after I graduated high school in 1985, I became an Atlanta police officer. I never regretted a day. I never had a bad day. I enjoyed every assignment that I ever had. I only had two, really, the streets and homicide. They kept me in the housing projects where I forged relationships that last until this day. And it's the greatest career I could ever pick for myself. I have no regrets because I'm a people person and this is a people sport. If you don't love people, don't work homicide. You better love you some people. Mm-hmm. And that's what kept me afloat this time, this whole time.
15 years as a police officer on the streets.
My first 15 were in the guts, the toughest neighborhoods in the city. That's where I worked. At night, in the dark, from, you know, 11 at night till 7 in the morning was my first 10 years. In the dark, in them PJs, working hard. And, you know, you're issued a 38 special, a six-shot revolver, when everybody else running around like it's New Jack City, you know, with Uzis and all these other cannons they had. So I realized back then the gun is your least important weapon in this business.
What's the weapon?
Your common sense and respect for people keep you alive in this business. If you got common sense and you respect your fellow man, your fellow woman, if you respect society, society takes care of you. Mm-hmm. I gunfire, it was like working in a MASH unit where I worked my first 10 years. Constant gunfire. Imagine coming to work in the dark and all you hear are people letting off rounds. I mean, it was just, I would hear it in my dreams. It didn't bother me. That was my life. I was 20 years old, hit the street when I was 21, and that was my life till 31. I banged around for about 5 more years, and in my 15th year, I made detective and went straight to homicide.
And did you, I know you said you wanted to be a homicide detective early on, but did you even, what was the process like? One day you're on the streets and the next day you're in homicide? Like, how does that work? How do you even transition to that? Like,
it's unbelievable. So, I mean, there's no test in the year 2000 when they're passing out the detective badges.
How they, eeny, meeny, miny, mo, or what is that?
Reputation. Some people had a good rabbi, and that rabbi would pull them up to make detective. You never know how you end up in certain assignments. It's some kind of chess match or checkers match that goes on with the brass. I don't know how I ended up in homicide. I didn't put in for it. I got put in homicide, and me and Velasquez were put in homicide without having started off in a less lethal assignment like auto theft or larceny. They sent us straight to the meat and the potatoes. We went right to homicide the night after we got sworn in as detectives. It was unbelievable. And, you know, we're on day shift, too, which is the creamy shift if you're working homicide.
I mean, I just have to say, I think that's... That had to be intimidating, no? Like, all of a sudden, like, I'm thrown into this role, and yeah, you're the cream of the crop, but, like, I gotta pretend I know what I'm doing type of thing.
I can't speak for the Puerto Rican, but I was hungry. Yeah. I had an insatiable appetite to get this done. Now, we have two zones in the city back then, Zone 1 and Zone 3. I did 10 years in Zone 3 in the dark, my first decade. Going into my 10th year, I was sent to Zone 1, which is Bankhead. I stayed there for 5 years. I make detective. They put a necktie on me and a suit jacket. Guess where I'm going for the next 15 years? To Zone 1 and Zone 3. It was like homecoming. Mm-hmm. I had worked my way through those neighborhoods. Everyone knew me. It was almost as if it was easy. Now, it looked easy, but it really wasn't. You still had to maintain the confidence of your constituency, the people that you serve. Mm-hmm. And I served. And those people helped me, you know, become what I am today. I mean, they helped me. They told me things they wouldn't tell other cops. I know that for a fact. A lot of folks put their lives on the line because something happens when the people in the street know you're the real police. And I'm going to give you a quick example. So there was one prostitute that used to help me out with murders all the time. Every time there's a murder where I know she plied her trade as a prostitute, I would go pick her up under the cover of darkness. And I would take her back, you know, somewhere and talk to her about, did you see the murder? She would give me the names of witnesses. She would give me, you know, substantive facts that would lead to the arrest. At some point in our relationship, she said, Quinn, I don't want you to drop me off on the backside of the hood. I want you to drop me off right in the middle, and I want everybody to see me get out your car. She said, that's my protection. Mm-hmm. And I was like, shampoo, you want me to let you out in front of everybody? She said, Quinn, if they see me get out your car, ain't nobody gonna mess with me. Because they know if I end up dead, you coming to get them. I was her comfort.
Wow.
Man, she almost brought me to tears with that because she trusted that if anything happened, she felt I was her security. Mm-hmm. You know, at that point in my career, I felt like that was my coming out party. I'm not afraid to tell when it's you. Now, she wouldn't do that for everybody else.
Yeah.
But we had a relationship. Mm-hmm. And she knew nobody wanted to be associated with her death if she was with me. That's somebody I never gave money to. That's someone I never had a reward. There was no rewards given out. She gave it to me because she had a relationship. It was crazy. It's the last thing I would have thought she ever said. And she's been missing for some years. She's a missing persons case now. I don't know what happened to her. I can't say, but I hope to invigorate the missing persons squad to get out here and see what they can do to find my girl.
You know, you never know who's listening now.
Yeah, Shampoo.
Everybody maybe we can help her. Find Shampoo.
She was up in Pittsburgh, city of Atlanta, on McDaniel Street. That's where she did her thing. And she's been missing now for a number of years. It pains me. I'm not a missing persons detective. I don't know. I'm retired. It's over. But I'd love to see my girl. If anybody knows anything about her disappearance.
Well, you're retired, but you're still very busy. You're still with Atlanta PD, right?
Yeah, I consult with them. I'm like a in-house murder incubator. You know, I just sort of... I help the detectives find their way in these investigations. I'm under contract, so a lot of flexibility. I teach in real time,
right.
Homicide investigation.
That's an interesting concept, and I think that's very important. You know,
I think other departments should adopt it. You got these old cats that retire.
You're basically a mentor.
An in-house mentor in real time. When the murder happens, these young cats and ladies, they're in a situation where they bump their heads and they can't move the case any further. They call me in. They come over to my cubicle. Quinn, you know, what's up? And I'll give them what I got. You know, I'll throw in and, you know, try to help them out. Sometimes I have to push them out the way and go ahead and finish the interview, though, because I just like talking. So that happens.
Well... what's on tap for, what's next in your adventures? What's the future like for David Quinn, superstar of Atlanta Homicide?
I'm still defining chapter two. You've got this contract that I have with the city, after working 30 years, you have to push away slow from the only thing you've ever done. Being a police officer is the only full-time job I ever had. 2 years after high school, I got the job. I'm coming up on age 54. I have to slowly transition out of this profession. But I really believe 2018, this is it for me. Yeah, that'll be 33 years affiliated with the Atlanta Police Department. I've been a contractor for the last three, so it's time to go.
Let's just say blue sky. Anything goes. What's your three wishes?
I would love to just do the lecture circuit. I would love to write because I've got one book already in the cooker. I'm just about finished with it. It's kind of a life story wrapped around a couple of cases that I worked. And I've got several books in my brain. And I want time just to sit down and write those books and, you know, finish that material and get it out there and see if, you know, somebody wants to chew on it. See if, you know. Little light reading at the coffee house where there's little murder and mayhem involved. I mean, so that's what I'm trying to do.
Wow.
So we'll see what happens.
Well, we're excited to see what's next.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for joining us on Inside Crime.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And that's it for this episode of Inside Crime. For more information about our show, go to our website, InsideCrime.com. Feel free to drop us an email, or you can reach me on Twitter. My handle is @AngelineDC. Again, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm your host, Angeline Hartman. Please be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode of Inside Crime.